They have music at the beginning of that. My name is John Schramm. This is the fifth in a series, and if you've been here 2 weeks, the tenth in a series, all of which have had a title, starting with the Holden theme for the summer, Gentle Justice, and then giving a subtitle, Toward a Healthy Spirituality. If you've been here at any of the others, we've been spending some time each time on what does that word mean, spirituality. It's a kind of a new word, especially for Protestants. It's a it can be a faddish word. I'm hoping if you've been to any of the sessions, or if you are only at this one, that it becomes a word that describes something which is not faddish, and which describes a way in which we can be alive and awake and aware. That it refers to the full work of the Spirit within us. And we have been working under the premise that a healthy spirituality comes down, expresses itself, includes at least 4 points. And we've simply, for these 10 sessions, been going around that circle and emphasizing one of them each time, but always linking them. That's why all the arrows link with one another. We've always been linking them with the other points. Your spirituality does not have to start on your own with no shape to it at all. We who are living within a spirituality that includes being called followers of the way and includes an affirmation of one who was the Word made flesh, namely Jesus, have a norm, and that Word is the norm for our spirituality. We've been saying that spirituality is nurtured in your own solitude, in times when you are disillusioned, in times when you separate yourself from the cultural illusions and find out who you really are and hear the truth in a way that maybe you don't hear it if you never get away. We've also said that there is a corporateness, an assumption of a community of people, that it is not individualistic. And if you've been here at all at Holden before, you know that the spirituality that's assumed at Holden is active in the world. It's not a retreat from it. One way to say that is Holden is a good place to come to only if it's a good place for you to leave. One of the reasons that we have short-term staff at Holden is that cuts out the possibility that people come here for the very wrong reason of running away from life and running away from the world. It's a good place to come only if it's a good place to leave, and that our spirituality is lived out in the world. In other words, we are to be present in the world the way Jesus was present in the world. Jesus is our norm. We are to be present in the world with other people who have Jesus as a norm. That's what our community is about. And in order to be present in the world and not be conformed to this world, but rather be transformed from within, we need the times of solitude. You get some idea, briefly, of how we've been going around that circle. The other assumption has been that growth for you probably will be for you to move into one of the areas that has not been a major part of your own spirituality. If you tend to be someone who is alone a lot, growth for you probably is to experience community. Even when community, Mary quoted me last night, even when we use as our definition for community the place where the person you would least like to be with in all the world lives. And when that person leaves, someone takes his or her place within a week. Even when that's the case, there's a chance for growth there. And if your spirituality has been very, very active, if when you speak about yourself, you name Bread for the World and the last civil disobedience action, and that you are at meetings every night of the week or whatever, probably growth for you might be some solitude and some chance to step back from this overly active spirituality. What we have not done this week is to say, what does that center mean? And that's what we do tonight. It's possible to come to Holden and have a summer theme, Gentle Justice, hear that theme every day while you're here, and not really have any content to that. We've put that at the very center of what it means to be spiritual. what it means for us to have a healthy spirituality. I'd like to do what we've done a couple times. This is for you to talk with one other person for about 30 seconds, not a lengthy discussion. Just tell somebody else in this room what you think gentle justice means, and listen to at least one other person in this room as to what they think gentle justice means. Go, 60 seconds at the most. We need four table wipes. No, we need... We need six people who share either what you said or what you heard quickly to get some sense of the diversity or the kind of consensus. What did you hear or what did you say? Gentle justice. Anybody, over here first.
Do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
A golden rule, understand. Thank you. Somebody back in there. Yes.
Stereo living.
Pardon?
Stereo living.
Stereo?
Stereo.
Stereo.
Rather than hi-fi.
Stereo living rather than monaural. All right. How about that? You can tell what age we're in when we have ways to describe something. Stereo living. Yes.
Situational ethics.
Situational ethics. People know what that means? Joseph Fletcher. What would love command in this situation? Other people?
Fairness and respect.
Fairness, respect. Thank you. Anybody else?
Forgiveness.
Pardon?
Forgiveness.
Forgiveness. Thank you.
Redeeming the victimizer.
Redeeming the
victimizer.
The victimizer. Thank you.
A witness for justice.
Think about
witness
holding,
for justice.
Think about holding before you react.
Think about holding before you react. Is anybody struck that we used oxymoron the other night as a phrase to describe two things that we put together that, when you think about it, they don't go together? Jumbo shrimp. A deafening silence. Or
awfully nice.
Awfully nice. Does gentle justice strike anybody that way or not? No one said... strange combination of words that don't seem to go together. Is any? Do you think?
Okay.
Okay.
It was the opposite of using the sword, which was the traditional notion of justice.
Okay. Opposite of using the sword, which was the traditional understanding of justice. Justice, I think, kind of technically means to set things right. Now, can you set things right gently? My fear is, the reason that I wanted one of the sessions this week to center on that phrase in the middle of our spirituality, my fear is that it will, that we're all kind of comfortable with it because it sounds like it's nice. That we will set things right and no one will get hurt. Or that it's for those of us who tend to be cowardly, it's our kind of justice because we don't like conflict. And we don't like social dislocation. Gentle justice is for church folks who really don't like the tough qualities of life in the world. My fear is that it sounds too nice. My highest regard for it is I think it points to the tradition, the richest tradition of what it means to be followers of the way. I'm not saying it isn't the right theme. I'm saying maybe we can get at the content of the theme by talking about it with some other words and then coming back to gentle justice. I've chosen the one which I equate with gentle justice, Satyagraha, and it comes from Mohandas Gandhi. Gandhi could have used the word nonviolence in his own language. Sometimes he did. In the language that he spoke, they had a word for violence. It was himsa, H-I-M-S-A. And in his language, similar to ours, you can make the opposite of that by adding an A. So ahimsa would have been nonviolence, and sometimes he uses that word. But he coined a word. He put a word together in order to describe his form of gentle justice, and satyagraha is that word. In this book, this is in the bookstore, by the way. If you want the major book that's behind the first part of tonight's session, it's Gandhi on Nonviolence, edited by Thomas Merton, with a very fine introduction by Thomas Merton. This is what Merton says about Satyagraha at the beginning of this book. For Gandhi, there was no syncretism, no indifferentism. Gandhi had the deepest respect for Christianity, for Christ and the gospel. And when he talked about following his way of Satyagraha, he believed he was following the law of Christ. Then in the footnote it says, this is a term coined by Gandhi. Its root meaning is holding on to truth. By extension, it means resistance by nonviolent means. So probably, if you've heard any definition of Satyagraha, it has been truth power or soul power. And I hope that we understand that the word power does not necessarily mean violent power. Martin Luther King, who also could have been used tonight as an illustration of gentle justice, understood power in the deepest sense to be able, posse, to be able. Rollo May, who's written about violence and innocence, power and innocence, has said that the finest expression of power is creative nonviolence, and that violence is unimaginative, non-creative communication. It's when you do not have power that you have to be violent. It's when you do not feel capable or able that you use non-creative communication, namely hit, instead of being able to evoke and to, okay? So we do use the word power. It's not the absence of power. I wonder if you were struck by the first part of that. Gandhi had the deepest respect for Christianity, for Christ, for the gospel. In following his way of Satyagraha, he believed he was following the law of Christ, and it would be difficult to prove that this belief was mistaken or that it was in any degree insincere. When we have the word at the top of our spirituality, are you surprised that we use someone who was technically not a Christian as our illustration of the one whose spirituality lived out gentle justice? I just want you to know that when Gandhi was asked, where did you get your understanding of Satyagraha, truth power, soul power? His answer always was the Sermon on the Mount. And he usually added, and if I had found that the Christians also followed the Sermon on the Mount, I would have become one. I found that they did not, and so I thought integrity for me would be to follow the one that taught the Sermon on the Mount in my own way, not join the official group that bore his name and did not follow that. Do you want to fight with that historically? Or did Gandhi have some reason to say that we who officially bear his name are not the best illustration historically of gentle justice? I want you to know that he had a high regard for living word and for Jesus the incarnate word. A high regard, enough that he based his life on Jesus' words. Let me also give you a few other things about Gandhi. The whole Gandhian concept of nonviolent action and Satyagraha is incomprehensible if it's thought to be a means of achieving unity rather than as the fruit of an inner unity already achieved. I don't think you'll understand Satyagraha, even as we tell stories about it, if you don't understand that for Gandhi, the principal disciplines of those Satyagrahi. All you have to do is put an I instead of an A and you have the disciples of truth power. The principal disciplines were over in what you would consider to be more spiritual than political. Fasting, prayer, vigils, asceticism of some kind, discipline of the body. Gandhi never separated the dimension of the inner unity of a person and the expression of nonviolence. In fact, I'm going to jump way down to his assessment of his work at the end of his life. I have admitted my mistake. I thought our struggle was based on nonviolence. In reality, it was no more than passive resistance. Once Gandhi said, I have never once been passive my whole life. So don't think of nonviolence as the absence of action. And let me go back. Whereas in reality, it was no more than passive resistance, which essentially is a weapon of the weak. It will lead naturally to armed resistance whenever possible. Or again, nonviolence is my creed. It's what I believe. It's my faith. It's my life. It never was of Congress. This is the official government in India. With the Congress, it was a policy. Can you feel the difference between what we're talking about being a creed and being a policy? I also think the difference sometimes that we've seen in our own lifetime, in the anti-Vietnam War, in some people who follow Cesar Chavez, in some people who followed Martin Luther King, that the nonviolence was not a way of life, it was a tactic. And you could tell the difference. You could see when it had power and when it didn't. A tactic does not have much power. A life being expressed always has power. That's another reason that I think I'm using Gandhi tonight. Let me, this is not easy for a group to sit and listen to someone read some quotes, so I'm going to keep them at a minimum, but I want to read a few. I don't know of any other way for you to begin to get some sense of Gandhi putting together something that ended with gentle justice. I'm going to start with the word. These are direct quotes from Gandhi every time. Jesus lived and died in vain if he did not teach us to regulate the whole of life by the eternal law of love. Again, Jesus was a man who was completely innocent, offered himself as a sacrifice for the good of others, including his enemies, and became the ransom of the world. It was a perfect act. How's that for a non-Christian talking about our loyalty to one whose vicarious atonement was for the life of the world? Now, nonviolence as our very nature. If love or nonviolence be not the law of our being, the whole of my argument falls to pieces. Or again, nonviolence, and each time this is better translated satyagraha. I'm just going to use nonviolence. I think you'd get tired of my trying to say that word. It is not a garment to be put on and off at will. Its seat is in the heart, and it must be an inseparable part of our very being. Or Gandhi on cowardice. Nonviolence as passive, if it seeks to harm the adversaries in ways that do not involve force, to this cowardly nonviolence, Gandhi prefers an honest resort to force. If you have violence in your heart, the first thing Gandhi said is do not be passive, work for justice. And if violence is in your heart, then you have to express that. But that's far better than having a cloak of nonviolence covering your cowardice. Don't ever hide behind a cloak of nonviolence when it's your own cowardice. It is better to be violent than to put on the cloak of nonviolence to cover impotence. Violence is any day preferable. Or to take the name of nonviolence when there's a sword in your heart is not only hypocritical and dishonest, it is cowardly. Nonviolence is the greatest and most active force in the world. One cannot be passively nonviolent. Or these are some times when he just kind of fleshed out a further understanding of satyagraha. Listen to half a dozen of them. It is incomprehensible if it is thought to be a means of achieving unity rather than the fruit of an inner unity already achieved. It cannot be proved by argument. There's no way I will argue you into being a satyagrahi in a session at Holden. It should be proved by persons living it in their lives with utter disregard of consequences to themselves. I thought back of another session in our spirituality when I quoted Clarence Jordan. Faith is not belief in spite of the evidence. That's called foolishness, Clarence Jordan said. Faith is not belief in spite of the evidence. It is risk in spite of the consequence. Now that's Gandhi. And that's, I think, what the word calls us to. To lay down one's life for what considers to be right is the very core of satyagraha. I am so continually amazed that people say, well, they were nonviolent and they died. You You're talking about following Jesus and coming into something that's going to be nonviolent, and we got hurt. Did you ever hear of the recruiting sergeant for the Marines say, come on in and you may not get hurt? There's a guarantee. This is the same struggle. The difference is whether or not you're willing to inflict suffering. The difference is not whether or not you're willing to. Secondly, he said, there were people who were injured, but the injuries would have been far greater if we had gone with clubs and if we had started to escalate and had also gotten guns. Thirdly, and he said, most important, all the suffering that day we endured, we inflicted none of it. That's satyagraha. Do you get some idea of gentle justice, not necessarily meaning nobody got hurt, but this strong commitment that the lashing out and the violence would not come from us, even if we had to endure it, even unto death. That's what we're talking about with Gandhi. Let's pause there for just a minute to see if you have any questions or reactions or comments at this time. Are there any? Can you apply it to raising teenagers? I hope so. In fact, I think the Quakers are on the right track when they say, unless we begin in the home, unless we begin with the importance of non-competitive games, that's what the new games book is all about, and unless we have models for our kids, and unless we model this in our home, we're talking about grand political theory, and we're not talking about reality. Now, let me also say, I'm not sure it's any easier with teenagers in the home than it is dealing with an empire that's oppressive. In fact, we probably theorize about we would do well with the big test, but I don't do well with the obnoxious neighbor or my present teenager. We always kind of have conditional living, but I hope so. I hope it has to do with teenagers. Are there other comments or questions?
How do you apply that to mud?
Okay, I'm going to get to that with a particular story, and then I want to come back to you and have your reaction to it. Yes?
I can't remember which journalist said it. It was someone who commented at one time that Gandhi was successful because he was dealing with a basically just society.
Okay, all right. Two major reactions to any story of nonviolence. First of all, it worked for Gandhi and it worked for Martin Luther King because they were dealing with the British government, which essentially had a sense of fair play and what have you, and Martin Luther King, the United States. It would not work against an Adolf Hitler. That's almost all, and that, I think you have to look at that. Is that why it worked? The second question is, almost always, what would you do if someone broke into your house and was about to harm your infant in a crib? John Howard Yoder got that question so often that one of his last books was What Would You Do If? And he starts with that question and has a whole book on the nonviolent options to the situation that almost always comes up if you give a talk about nonviolence. So let's talk a little bit about, did it work for Gandhi only because he was dealing with the British? Is that, do you think that's true? And that you have to be very selective in when this would work, and that if you're living in a certain situation, don't bother. A real tyrant won't be impressed.
If my understanding of history is correct, when the early Christians lived during the period of the Roman Empire, that's when it was a kind of government, and I see the Christians as being very active in the expression of their faith and their belief.
Okay.
And not passively resistant. They, as a result, received suffering and even death, but did not inflict it.
True. Okay. One of the things would be to look at the emperors at the time the New Testament was written, including the ones who put Christians on stakes, dipped them in tar, and lit them to light the patio parties. I don't know that there have been any who have taken their place with. And Nero was not the worst. I mean, we think of Nero fiddling while Rome burned. There were some others that were, Diocletian, I think, comes to my mind as one of the worst. And it was in that time that if we're taught to live in the world the way Jesus, so if almost certainty of success will be required before this is the center of our spirituality, then I think there are some times in history. And Bonhoeffer is often cited. Bonhoeffer declared himself as a pacifist. He went to study in India. He went to study Gandhian and Del Vasto, Alonzo Del Vasto, and other people's type of pacifism. He used the image of there are times when the driver of the wagon is insane, and at those points you have to get rid of the driver of the wagon. You can't talk about social adjustments, and it's not time to pick up the wounded who are being crushed. You got to get the driver out of the seat, and was part of an assassination plot. That's often used as the argument against the possibility of using these kind of premises in your social action, because Bonhoeffer decided to against Hitler, so that certainly, yeah,
well, that's,
I saw
that's
your
that's
name.
What I was going to ask, is do you think that they were effective social media? Are they effective, or, I mean, we're looking back now,
yeah,
so are we saying they are effective, or are we saying they were not?
Okay.
Hitler was crazy, right? Again, does this work with the people that are insane?
Okay. Let me give two brief answers to that, and then hold some of that until we get a few more stories. I don't think the question is whether or not Bonhoeffer had the right to be in a plot against Hitler or not. I'm not going to judge Bonhoeffer on that. I do think if there had been enough good Lutherans way before who had said no to Hitler, Bonhoeffer would have not had the dilemma that he had. If you want to know where I am on that, I'm with Rosencrantz and Guildensterner Dead, that little play where they say to one another, there must have been a time somewhere near the beginning when we could have said no and somehow we missed it. I'm going to be a little angry because I am. I get somewhat tired with academic questions and people are not saying no to the arms race today. And then sometime they will say, we had no choice because all of us are just as complacent as were Lutheran Germans as they saw swastikas come into the sanctuary and all that other stuff, and they didn't say no. So I'm not disillusioned about the possibilities of nonviolence, because there are some historical times when you could say it just couldn't have worked there. Just go back, and if people had understood this, if the church had had this kind of spirituality at a particular point in Germany, I don't think there would have been a Hitler. And that's, it seems to me, a much more important question for us today. But it'll sound like if you ask a question, you're going to get one of Schramm's sermons, and it is a legitimate question. But I think we also need to look at some prior questions when we ask it.
Well, you're really saying, though, that still the church in its nonviolent form could have done some things.
Yes.
So the two connect.
Yes.
I think
they do.
Okay.
All right. Let me tell a couple questions, because I want to get to the one about being mugged. I'm going to give you a list of things that I think people think of as the options when you're confronted with a conflict situation. Fight. That's one of the options. And it at least isn't cowardice, right? Let's put it up there first. What's the opposite?
Flight.
People understand that. Turn two heels and get out of there. But we do think of it as cowardice. How about neutrality? Don't get involved. There are people who say, I've been nonviolent all my life, and what they mean is, I've never got involved with any conflict. They don't know whether they're nonviolent or not. They never had a test. 37 people heard that woman, Genevieve's, call for help in that apartment, and none of them got involved. They were all nonviolent, right? No. She was killed. Those 37 had poured out of their apartment, they wouldn't have even had to kill the guy with the knife. 37 of them could have restrained him till they got into some hospital. They weren't nonviolent, they were neutral. Or capitulation. Give in. Cry uncle. Don't fight it. Now, if we're talking about satyagraha or gentle justice, I think everybody, if you gave this test, everybody would say it is not fight. Right? I think too many people think it's some combination of the other three. Neutrality, capitulation. Maybe you'd like a word compromise better than capitulation. Sounds put compromise. Think of it as some combination of the other three. What I'm trying to say by choosing Gandhi, who else could we choose? I've named Cesar Chavez, Martin Luther King, Dorothy Day. There could be lots of them we could choose. Some way to say satyagraha or nonviolence is none of the above. It is as far from capitulation, neutrality, and flight as it is from fight. That's what I'm trying to say. Let me illustrate that a couple ways. Maggie is in our community in Minneapolis. Maggie is a nurse. She's in Pax Christi, which is the National Roman Catholic Peace Organization. Of all the people I know, she probably lives, feels, breathes, and assumes satyagraha as much as anybody I've ever met. If that wasn't true, I don't think this story would have ever happened. So you have to assume that it is not some technique, but it flows from an inner well-being, rootedness, and a commitment that at whatever happens, violence is not one of your options. When you cut out that option, you have to be more creative. Maggie works as a nurse, and this night got off at 11 o'clock at night after working 8 hours. And she lives, there are people from other cities that say Minneapolis does not have any rough sections. Well, they're not as rough as New York and Detroit, but there are some sections that have street crime. You know, and she lives in one of those. She got off the bus at 11 o'clock, walking alone, and a man grabbed her by the arm. And she was fairly far from home yet. And he immediately started to drag her, and she immediately started to speak. Wait a minute. What are you doing? My name is Maggie Ferris. I just worked 8 hours as a nurse, and I'm tired. And I wanted to get home. I have a husband and 3 children. What's your name? And the hand loosened just a little bit. That's disarming. To grab a woman and have her engage you in conversation. There's even a book that calls what she did moral jujitsu. It's another form of disarming somebody. She was frightened. She's a human being. She was frightened, but she didn't let that make her lose her sense of here was a fellow human being, and she was not going to use violence, even though she was threatened. Her life, whether it was rape that was on his mind, or robbery or something, or assault. Another man walked by with a small dog. Maggie has also got a very good sense of humor. She said, I calculated very quickly. Should I scream and get him to help, or should I do something else? She said, it could be that my strong commitment to nonviolence determined my action, or it could be that the guy with the dog was really a very small man. Anyway, she took her assailant by the other arm and said, come behind here. Let's get out of the way of this other man. And pulled him into a kind of more secluded place. And she said, we need to talk. For 2 hours, they talked. Vietnam vet, miserable life, some drugs. 2 hours, they talked. Maggie said, what does one say after 2 hours? Does one say, may I go now, when this all started with this man grabbing me? What she did say was, you know, this is a very rough neighborhood, and I am frightened when I walk in alone. Would you walk me home? This is absolutely true. She did not tell him, and I don't know that nonviolence means that you do something that's just absolutely foolish. You may have thought everything up to now was foolish. She did not tell him that her husband and three kids were not home. They weren't. They were out of town. She said, my husband and three children will be waiting for me. I think that was good sense. Anyway, he walked her home, and the next day, there was flowers. There were flowers delivered with this note, thank you for being my friend. You are the only one who ever listened. My wife said to her, you could have been killed or raped. You could have been killed. And she said, I know that. I think I'm ready to meet my maker. I don't think he was. You better put costly, gentle justice, right? We better describe it with a word. I don't know of a better story than that. And that's within the last year in Minnesota, in Minneapolis. That's not Gandhian, and it's not first century. That's what we're talking about. There would have been no power there if that was only a tactic for her. Don't try that as a way, instead of mace, to protect yourself on the streets. There has to be, you'd have to meet her to know how thoroughgoing her commitment to that is. But those kinds of stories are still part of what it means to have some option, even to being mugged on the street, with a commitment to gentle justice. I think this is not as dramatic, Mary, but I think it's just as consistent. We moved to a farm in West Virginia, and we put up a sign that said, no honey. We loved the wild turkeys that walked through and the deer. And we didn't want any hunting on the property. Well, this raised some kind of a murmur in the town. Or there isn't any town. It's called Seldom Seen. A pickup truck drove in one day and he stopped at the fence that goes around the house. That's kind of customary. He stopped. The trouble was, he rolled his window down a little bit, made Mary come out of the house, and she stood in the rain while he sat in the truck. And he was angry. So Mary said, hi, I'm Mary Schramm. What's your name? He said, number three. And she said, excuse me? He said, I'm three, number three. He was the third son in the family. He'd always been called number three. And she kept, oh, come on, everybody has a name. She finally got Harlan out of him. And he said, I'm going to hunt on your place. And she said, well, we prefer that people don't. He said, you can shoot me if you want. I'm going to hunt. Mary said, we don't own a gun. We never have owned a gun. We don't do any hunting because we don't have a gun and don't hunt. We wouldn't shoot you if we did have a gun, but we're just asking that people don't hunt on our place. So you can call the sheriff. He can bring out all the deputies he can find, and you won't stop me. She said, we wouldn't call the sheriff on anybody. We certainly wouldn't call the sheriff if you walked into our property, but we're asking you not to. He went on two or three times, and she said, well, we probably wouldn't do that, but we're asking you not to, and he quit. He said, hope you enjoy it here. He rolled up his window and left, and to my knowledge, he has never hunted. Let me tell you one more. This, I think, is what I think of as the kind of story that should have been in the papers during the civil rights movement, and it's the kind of stories that never makes the papers because of some assumption in our country about what news is. David was a young Quaker, lived in Washington, D.C., and he went down south with other people in what was called the sit-ins. Do you remember those? Black and white together would go in, order a Coke at a lunch counter. In other words, they would break a law that they thought was wrong and be civilly disobedient by sitting together at a lunch counter and order a Coke. Well, David came back and told the story. He and a black friend went into a drugstore in the Deep South, ordered a Coke, and he said you could just feel the tension in the room. And he said, and then I felt more than the tension in the room. He felt the unmistakable point of a very sharp knife in the middle of his back. Nonviolence is not a series of techniques, and you go through the book and you've learned them, but there are some basic principles, and David knew them. He was committed to nonviolence, and he also knew the principles, so he turned. You always personalize the encounter when it's one-to-one. You always look somebody straight in the eye if it's going to be a conflict situation. And he did. That meant that the knife was now at his heart. But he had to turn and face this person who was now his adversary. And he said, I have never seen any more depth of anger than I did in the eyes of this man. if there's any other general principle, it's keep the tension and the volume and the anger down with your voice. Talk softly. Don't let the decibels build up. So David talked very softly. And he said, friend, and you miss the whole evening and you miss the whole point if you don't know that he meant that. If he didn't mean that, it's a technique. Friend, whether you push that knife in or don't is obviously up to you. It's not up to me. I want you to know, in either event, I love you. And a hand shook, and the knife fell, and a huge, angry man ran from a drugstore, whipped by a power that he had never confronted before. He was used to reaching for another knife, and he was used to a clenched fist. He was not used to somebody saying, in either event, I love you. Don't get me wrong. Study the history of the world, and more often than not, the knife goes in. Oh, yes. Oh, I'm not naive. What I'm saying is, when that man was confronted with a power he had never confronted before, I'm saying that is power. That's not the absence of power. And it's probably the most radical power the world has ever experienced. And if our spirituality included it, the world would have some sense of light and salt and a witness to something. Our political action when we get violent in the streets is not too radical. It's not radical enough. It buys the world's assumptions of power instead of offering an option to them. And we have to find ways in which we tell that story and in which we encourage one another to have the courage to take our Lord at his word and to live that kind of thing out. We are very close to the end of the time. I knew that would be the case. I didn't give you a lot of time for your own reactions. We got a little of it, but let's give you another 5 minutes or so, and then I want to read something at the end. I want to nominate a saint, a Satyagraha saint, before we go to chapter.
John.
Yes.
When you use the word fight up there,
yeah.
One mental image that comes up is violence.
Yeah.
But the other one is opposition. And didn't Gandhi, for example, fight the system? He was opposed to what was unjust, what was unfair, and he took nonviolence.
Okay, yeah, I've never thought of that before. I guess we could have new content to the word fight. Can you fight nonviolently?
Yes.
Sure. Okay. Same way you can be angry and sin not. At least the Bible tells me to do that. Be angry and sin not. So fight and don't be violent. Sure. Okay.
Some of the modern art of negotiation skills, some of these kind of things, assume power in the individual face-to-face contact, all the things you're talking about, and I think it's a non-violent form of conflict using this very same principle. So,
okay.
I mean, yeah, I think fight is a word that is very, can have metaphors as well.
One of the things that I think is a stumbling block is people say, could we expect the Pentagon and the State Department to accept this as our national policy? I'm not sure that's what the church ought to be doing anyway, is telling the State Department and the Pentagon. I think the church ought to be the church and live out this option. That's when we're leaven and light and salt. At what other point do we wait until the whole world votes yes, until we follow Jesus at some point? When do we wait until the whole world agrees, until we're faithful, and yet when it comes to nonviolence, we kind of say, well, the world just wouldn't buy that. So we're not faithful because it won't pass a referendum in any country of the world. I just don't think that's necessarily the way we make our decisions about what faithfulness is.
The difficult thing that I see in this, we watched, many of us, cable TV watched moment by moment, 24 hours a day. It was the last March, when here the army with all their abilities in the Philippines, and here are these people out there just hugging the soldiers and loving them to death and stopping what was obviously scheduled to be a great bloodshed. Now, But it was still, John, eyeball to eyeball.
Right.
I love you, you're my brother, you don't want to hurt these people. My question, and it might be a question of many here, is how do you look eyeball to eyeball to something
yes.
like our nuclear policy
sure.
and this system, this juggernaut, which has no eyeballs?
Yeah.
Where do we look? Where do we hug?
I can't answer the last. Let me simply tell you, two friends of mine were in the Philippine Islands, and the bishop, Sin, which is an interesting name for
him. Yeah.
for that which could have been Cardinal Sin, for that which could have been the bloodbath, and instead was eyeball to eyeball.
Yeah.
He called for four cloistered Dominican sisters, and they were the first ones to walk and to begin that very changed day of hugging. Six or four cloistered Dominicans were his call to the monastery for the first people to move, and it changed the whole day. I just love the story. Yeah.
John, do you think it's any help that a little itty-bitty country like New Zealand has taken an anti-nuclear stand against one of its most powerful allies? Is that a help? We in New Zealand think that if the allies are saying, listen, buddy, it's not good enough what you're doing, you can't stand over me and say,
now,
yeah, you do what I say. Is it any help? We think it is, but it isn't.
Yes.
It is a tremendous help for me. But whether it will change the world or not, I don't know. But is it a help? Yes. Absolutely. It's a help. You could almost say our minor symbols a help, or did one solitary person dying one time, was that a help? I think all of that is a weight on the side, evidence, a first fruits, a witness, and whether it's a solitary witness or one little nation or not, or whether it's the mouse that roared, which was always one of our favorite films up there, yes, we're very grateful to you. Let me, since it is almost 5:00, let me share this as the saint of Satyagraha, and then we'll go to chapel. Telemachus. How many have heard of Telemachus? This is a book in the bookstore. This is, okay, a couple of you. This is the kind of thing our kids need. This is kind of an alternative to Rambo that I'm suggesting. Telemachus was a monk who lived in Asia Minor about the year AD 400, and during his life, the gladiatorial games were very popular. The gladiators were usually slaves or political prisoners who were condemned to fight each other unto death for the amusement of the crowd. People were fascinated by the sight of spurting blood. Telemachus was very much disturbed that the Christian emperor, Honorius, sponsored these games and that so many people who called themselves Christians went to see them. What could be farther from the spirit of Christ than the horrible cruelty of the gladiatorial games? The church was opposed to the games, spoke out against them, but people did not listen. Then Telemachus realized that talking about this evil was not enough, and it was time to do something. What could one lone monk do against the whole Roman Empire? He was unknown. He had no power. The games had been entrenched in the Roman life for centuries. Nothing that he could possibly do would ever make a difference. He traveled to Rome. All the people were caught up in today's game, told him to come along. So he went along. He saw the emperor sitting over in the amphitheater. The gladiators came out into the center of the arena. Everybody was tense. Everybody was quiet. Now two strong young men drew their swords and the fight was on. One of them would probably die in a few minutes. Which one would it be? Then Telemachus rose from his seat and he ran into the arena. He held high a cross. He threw himself between the two combatants. In the name of our master, he cried, stop fighting. The two men hesitated. Nothing like this had ever happened before. They didn't know what to do, but the spectators were absolutely furious. Telemachus had robbed them of their anticipated entertainment. They yelled wildly, stampeded toward the center of the arena. They became a mob, and with sticks and stones, they beat Telemachus to death. Far down there in the arena lay a little battered body of a monk. But then the mob grew quiet, and there was a feeling of revulsion at what they had done. Emperor Honorius, rose, and he left the Colosseum. The people followed him. The games for the day were over. Honorius sensed the mood of that day, and he took that opportunity to issue an edict. There has never been a gladiatorial game since. So it was in the year 404, one individual dared to say no, and gladiatorial games were over. That's my nomination of the saint for Satyagraha, Telemachus. Don't forget. Thank you.